And now, back to Stand Up with Pete Dominic on Indy, SiriusXM 104.
All right, I am Pete Dominic. Thank you, voiceover guy. And it is Thursday, June 6th, D-Day, 69th anniversary of D-Day.
My brother's birthday.
And more importantly than D-Day, apparently, it's Barry Ritholtz's brother's birthday.
June 6th.
Barry Ritholtz is in studio at Ritholtz. He came in early to do a little television on the Bloomberg, and so he's in a suit. He's fired up today.
Suit and tie.
He's got a lot of energy. He's got a lot of caffeine and maybe other drugs. We don't know. We're not sure. We did take a sample. We did take a sample earlier, but only to see if they were performance-enhancing drugs, not anything, you know.
A combination narcotics. Of Ambien and Viagra. It's a race to
see. Do you ever have any kind of sleep issues?
When I go to the – so every day I'm up 4:35 o'clock. That's my schedules. I get up.
I beat you by an hour.
I get up. I that's the time I do my writing. It's part of my routine. I started
Hold on. Before you
I started it over a decade ago, and it's really an enormous help to have that sort of routine. When I go to California, when I go to the West Coast, so I have a trip to Vancouver, I have a trip to Denver, I was just in L.A., I never use an alarm clock. So I'm out and about with people till 11 o'clock at night. I go to bed and I wake up at 2 a.m. because that's when I get up. 2 a.m. is 5 o'clock. So I asked the doctor, hey, what can I do? He gave me a prescription for Ambien, which a friend who's a biotech analyst said, Ambien's a terrible molecule. Switch to Lunestra. It's a much better. And he was right. It's like a nice, light sleep.
Really? Lunestra's better than Ambien? Anyone else?
I find Ambien is a drunk sleep.
Hero?
Knocks you out, groggy in the morning, not a restful sleep. Ambien, Lunestra, nice, light sleep. The dog has woken me up when I'm on Lunestra. So if I'm out in California for a week, I come back. I want to get back to New York Times, stay up late, pop a pill. Now I'm on
different
New York Times.
Different molecule.
Very different biomolecule.
That's how I feel about some of the allergy drugs.
I try and stay away from. I'm not a big self-medicator. Mm. Unless I really have a pounding headache, I won't take an Advil. If I'm physically in pain, I'll avoid doing something. I have adult allergies. I didn't get them until I was mid-30s.
Yeah.
And I found Zyrtec is good. It doesn't make me groggy.
Let me ask you this
But I try not to take it. I haven't taken an allergy pill this whole spring.
Oh, really?
This whole
spring. I've been taking them. Yeah. I've been taking them.
So can I tell you?
And I grew up this year. I can officially swallow a bigger pill this year.
Can I tell you the best thing you should do?
You
know a little bit about everything.
I say you know a little bit.
You say I know a little bit about everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Go get yourself a hefty HEPA air filter. I use something called Blue Air or Blue Rhino or something.
Uh-huh.
Put it in your bedroom. You'll find your allergy reactions drop 50-60%. It's a huge.
Really?
You're taking all the crap out of the
Yeah, but
air.
How do you know that's that that's
I,
correlated?
Before and after.
Yeah, but it could be anything.
Try it and see if I'm right.
All right.
It'll cost you $200-$300 to get a good one.
We're broke. We can't do that.
Come on, man. Don't make me disclose your salary on the air.
Go ahead.
You're a public company. I know exactly what you got paid. I did the FOI request. I could disclose.
Request.
Right.
How big of a story
you can
is
afford a $300 air filter?
How big of a story is this NSA Verizon wiretap?
You know, it's a story because all these other pseudo scandals. You know, I don't think Benghazi is a scandal, but eventually they just start adding up and wearing down any incumbent. Second term is notorious for this. Look, we've been listening to Americans' telephone calls post 9/11. The NSA is building this enormous mountain out in the West to capture all this cellular data, all of this landline data, all this internet traffic. You know, all your communication belongs to us. It's no longer. I hate to say this because your porn habits are definitely, you know, in a file somewhere. But our expectations of privacy just continue to diminish. Look at the Boston Marathon bombing. They had these guys coming and going on 10,000 cams that are
everywhere.
Well,
yeah, but that had a lot to do with
how quickly they.
No, it had a lot to do with civilians having their cameras out because
I'm talking about the cameras that caught them walking to and from.
I don't know.
The scene.
Are you not sure?
Oh, absolutely. They're all security cams and store cams. And
but conspiracy theorists will tell you there's no picture or video of them putting their backpacks down with the bombs in them.
That's probably true because it's in the middle of a crowd. It's a way. These are all the cams are coming either from traffic cameras or storefront cameras, and where the bomb was dropped was nowhere near one of
How
those.
Come you're not concerned about that liberty security issue? You don't care
I am
about your phone,
I'll tell
your
you
porn
exactly
viewing
why.
Habits and your phone calls being listen
because
to?
I'm concerned about things that are important and within my control. There is nothing that you or I are going to do that's going to stop this. There's an inevitable march towards Big Brother. All we could do is tell people about it, but it ain't going to stop. I don't see any way on God's green earth this is going to stop. There's too many legitimate, privately owned cameras. Every store, every household has something built into their... Look, there's a camera here on her laptop. There's a camera on my iPad. There's a camera on your phone.
Yep.
When you're in public, you should not have any expectation of privacy because you ain't got any. Where I am not happy with knowing that my phone is being listened to, knowing that my internet email is being read. But that's why, you know, in all the mobster movies, in all the Godfathers, in The Sopranos, they never spoke on the phone. It was in the basement with noise running in the background. You can't. Your assumption has to be that wherever you go, someone is listening. Whatever you're using an electronic device, it is easily captured. You know, this sort of stuff, there are even programs that can capture
your keystrokes
and figure out.
I'm only upset because I don't think if they're listening to me or charting my keystrokes, they don't care. Like, I'm only upset that they're listening and I'm not interesting. Like, I think people listen. Like, they're listening to my phone conversation
concern.
Like they listen to the radio show. Like, oh,
so
boring.
You don't have a privacy concern. You're concerned about the NSA's Yelp review of your
yes,
stand-up.
Exactly.
He was kind of funny, but there was no real material. He just made fun of people.
Exactly.
And, you know, it was cute, but
that's an accurate critique of my act, by the way.
I know. I've seen it. I know. That's how I know why you
Well, that
the
was
radio.
Only at the Colbert Report.
That's
on,
true.
Which, right.
By the way, you killed at. And I told you the next time I was here, I said you just killed.
At Ritholtz is here. Barry Ritholtz is joining
those glances.
The conversation.
That's
well, a girl walks by. I do it to everybody, though.
Right.
Anybody walks by the studio, I take a look.
Yeah. No, but I see the way you linger.
I don't. Come on. I might have lasted a second longer on an attractive
right.
woman than I do.
Hey,
no,
you're a male.
I read a very interesting piece
in
Salon, I think, about a guy who fashions himself as a feminist, but finds himself giving creepy glances and having thoughts.
Right.
And it's like, what's wrong with me? You know, why
you
do
have
I
have a penis? That's the problem.
Well, that would be basically.
That's pretty much it.
Basically.
I'm walking with, so we have a couple of summer interns. This year, they're both male. I'm walking back from lunch with one of them on Madison Avenue. And this woman, this fairly attractive woman, is walking my way. She's in like a gym outfit. She's in this, I don't want to say sheer, but very, very translucent, like that, only thinner.
Don't point at an intern
thinner.
Walking
no, I'm
by
gesturing.
Here.
And she's braless, and she's walking my way, and you can't help but glance. And she gives me a dirty look, and I'm like, you know, I didn't tell you to wear a see-through shirt and no bra. Are you surprised that men walking down the street are staring at your bouncing
Melanie,
breasts?
Melanie, be honest.
She was reading. She didn't hear a word of that.
I think she did. She was trying to ignore
Oh, I heard
you.
Everything.
Right.
Yeah.
So when a
I
woman,
mean, I'm not saying
when
I
a,
made
when a
lascivious leer. I
when a woman dresses in a way that is...
this isn't it's her fault.
Is there any... can you blame a man for looking? It's never acceptable to say anything, to do anything. But what about a look?
Yeah. What do those New York things have to say to us about
Oh, Jesus.
What?
Oh, I just don't even know where to start.
Yeah. Start at the beginning.
Start
and then
at
go
the beginning.
To the middle,
anything,
work your way to
just,
the end.
Yeah, this isn't gonna solve anything with Barry.
Keith in New York,
anything
you're on stand up. Keith is our smartest listener. Barry doesn't like callers or other
I don't
people.
Say, I didn't say I don't like callers. I said when I'm
he's the smartest guy that calls the program.
Hit us, Keith.
Hey, you know, since you say you don't really care about privacy, Pete, I want Barry to state your salary on the air.
Oh, did I say I don't care about privacy?
No, you were joking and said you were more concerned about their review of your how boring
you don't
care
I will
that
tell you what.
Looking.
No, I will tell you. I will tell you this. I will honestly tell you this. The only reason I would care about my salary being set on the air is A, it puts me in a tough position negotiating with SiriusXM. But more importantly than that, my wife is bothered by it. And
right.
So it's out of respect. Yeah, I wouldn't care. I really don't. If my
all right,
wife
I'm
going to
disclose
care,
it. You ready?
If my wife didn't care, I wouldn't. I really don't. I mean, I am.
Can
an
I tell
open
you,
book.
you run a 3-hour radio show. It's fairly highly rated. It's Sirius. It's prime time, 6 to 9 a.m. It ain't that hard to take a guess and come up with a reasonable number. So whether the listeners know to the penny, I bet Keith can come up with a ballpark number that's close. Keith, give us a ballpark number.
It's not my field. I don't want to guess.
Just take a wild guess, just for laughs.
I wouldn't be able to.
You can't string six.
I think he's afraid of insulting me.
No, just go ahead. Come on, you won't insult him. It'll be good radio fun.
I would certainly hope. Just you're making a couple hundred.
Ha! Not even close. Just you have a high expectation of him. He's wildly underpaid.
What did you say? A couple hundred?
$200 a year.
Have I told you my salary? I think
yes,
I did.
You have.
I've told two people.
You've told me. I know exactly what it is.
Barbara Ehrenreich wrote in her book Nickel and Dimes exactly the opposite of what you're saying.
Is what?
They feel that they cannot negotiate if everyone knows their salary. She said when everyone says their salary, you get unions, which have gotten higher pay by everyone knowing their salary.
There's no Sirius XM union, though.
No, and I don't know why not. I mean, I don't know. I mean, because I think the moment we started making that murmur, I haven't really thought about that, but I'm a big supporter of organized labor. I think it's there's certain people at CNN where that work for free that really piss me off because I never go on CNN.
Can I tell you a hilarious after we're done with Keith, I have a hilarious Huffington Post story for you.
I just want to say privacy is extremely important because as we see with everyone that uses your private data, it can be monetized, and not only can it be monetized, it can be used in order to control, and whoever has that data has the ability to control. And there's
correct.
A reason that certain things are not permitted when you're in the NSA and there's a scandal about, you know, something secret in your life, you're out. You don't get, you know, the chance for blackmail. The idea that, you know, the government is going to have these things. And Barry, I take one exception with you. There's a big difference between private security cameras and the government security
cameras.
Yes,
absolutely.
And,
I'm with you.
You know, there's not even the constitutional issue, there's just a philosophical issue between them. But the very notion that the government has all this data not only puts them in a position where they have legal authority over you, but they have just a moral authority. And if you don't think that's true, you really need to read Justice Jackson.
Oh, no, it's totally true.
Federal prosecutor.
You're not getting an argument from us, Keith. You're absolutely right.
So I get very upset when I hear Pete talk about how much, you know, he's okay with, you know, the invasions of privacy. They're really not okay.
I'm not saying it's okay. I'm saying that it is beyond us as citizens' ability to push back on it because the toothpaste is out of the tube, and this is just it's an issue we're all going to be dealing with. And you're right. It is an invasion of privacy. It is important. There's just no way it's going to roll back. And by the way, if you go to London, where they have not only traffic cameras but speed cameras, the citizens are knocking down the poles that hold these cameras. They're spray painting the front.
Really?
They're doing stuff. The cameras are hated there. Hated.
Listen to this email from a listener who defends. He's a hardcore Democrat.
Yep.
He defends the Obama administration no matter what. I'd love to get your take on this issue. He says, I got to say I'm a little bit stunned at the shocked reaction of Glenn Greenwald's article. He's the one who had the exclusive scoop on this NSA Verizon relationship or that the NSA has.
For a decade.
He says, that's what he says. He says, anyone who's been paying attention should have known for years that this was going on. It was reported in USA Today in 2006. How is this a revelation now? It strikes me lot of people on the Democratic side of the aisle need to grow up about the nature of the national security state. It doesn't just disappear because a guy you like is in the White House. There are too many extremely compelling reasons for why any administration... for any administration to give this stuff up willingly.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. That's what I'm saying. It's not going to happen.
I was surprised the other way. I had thought that they were getting warrants without judicial approval. I mean, at least this was a FISA judge. But
they're getting this rubber stamp. This judicial approval is nonsense. It's a farce. It meets the hyper-legal technicalities that was mandated. But this is bullshit. This is not a real judicial approval. This is not a warrant. Hey, we have probable cause. It's like, wait, you're the guy who appointed me to this cushy job, and I just, you know, rubbed
Red Holtz
like
is stamping in studio.
It's crap.
For those of you.
That's crap.
That aren't in the studio. Keith, you're right about me. I mean, I'm, as always, I mean, this guy, I call him, he makes me think a lot. I mean, I don't always agree with him, but, you know, I don't always have a great argument either. Thank you, Keith.
So let's digress a bit and talk about salaries and workers and people who are not compensated for the job they do, because I have an issue with that.
Mm-hmm.
As do you.
Sure.
So now this
is why I generally try to support organized labor whenever I can, right, with my own purchases.
So
big purchases especially.
This is going to just overlook the white people problem, elitist New York East Coast socialist summer camp, Ivy League. Overlook all that stuff,
all right,
and just focus on the last part of this. So a friend, Josh Rosner, has a book that comes out called Reckless Endangerment. He co-writes it with Gretchen Morgenson of the Times, and we go to his book party. This is a couple of years ago. And I'll even give you the names because I don't care. So the former prize-winning journalist at the New York Times is now one of the very senior, if not the senior editor at Huffington Post, right? Now, Huffington Post was a private company with venture capital investment. It eventually was sold to the dumbest acquirer in history, which is AOL. For a cut $300 million, it made the already wealthy Arianna Huffington even wealthier. But it was her money, not her husband's. She did this herself, so kudos to her. But they built this model on this indentured serf structure where all these people do actual work, do research and writing and reporting, and basically give it to them for free, which is a model I object to. It undercuts real journalism. Wait, you're not a charity. You're a private, for-profit company. I wouldn't volunteer on weekends to be a barista at Starbucks or a greeter at Walmart.
But hold on.
So wait, but let me get to the punchline. So the managing editor says, hey, I've been reading The Big Picture for years. We love your stuff. Why don't you write for us? And I said, why don't you come to my house this weekend and mow my lawn? And he looks at me and goes, I don't understand. I said, well, you're asking me for valuable work product for free so I could subsidize, this was before they were bought, so I could subsidize your for-profit venture with my labor. You must think I'm a fucking moron, because only a fucking moron would give you their valuable work product
for free. I don't believe
you
said this to him.
I swear to God.
All right.
And I said, so the line was, come mow my lawn. And I said, I have to tell you, for a guy who worked at the Times, you're doing your part to help destroy journalism. You are undercutting any financial incentive for people to do real journalism. So the short answer is no, thank you. The long answer is shame on you. And then we were separated, and that was that.
Well, how do you know
at this point?
How do you know that when he said, "Why don't you come write for us," that he was saying for free?
I said, "Well, because the first question is, so what's your pay structure?"
Right.
By the way, they've asked me a dozen times. It's Seeking Alpha. It's Business Insider. It's HuffPo. There's a I forgot who did the article in the Times, but it was a nature of indentured serf was the line. It might have been I'm trying to remember the guy who's the New York Times media reporter, but there was a whole article on this, and I did
Brian Stelter, Bill Carter.
It might have been Bill Carter. Do a search on The Big Picture for the dangle, and right, it explains all this on how they promise you all this stuff, none of it ever shows up. Hey, come write for us for free. We'll build your brand. You'll develop your reputation. You'll get traffic. None of that stuff happens. You're just giving them valuable work for nothing, to which they're going to use as a basis to sell the company to somebody else, give you nothing, and pocket the money. So I said, come mow my lawn. He knew, by the way, he knew exactly what I meant. They had contacted me 100 times. Look, they have some celebrities, some liberal celebrities like Alec Baldwin and other people who write there for free. But they don't need the money. They don't care about the money. To them, it's just, ooh, I'm participating.
But
with this
isn't just Huffington Post. This is Business Insider. You're naming a whole bunch.
Now, Business Insider has actually eventually set up its own staff. They have 50 or 60 reporters. But Seeking Alpha Seeking Alpha does this. Nouriel Roubini has a site where they do this. And there are dozens of sites. I just got invited. This is hilarious. So I make a couple of shekels. I do okay. And I got an invite from about.com yesterday. I can show it to you on the iPad. Hey, we've been reading The Big Picture for years. We think you're great. We'd like you to become an expert in our finance section. If you do this, we're looking for 4 to 6, you know, posts, whatever it is, a week, a month, for which, you know, it's 400 to 600 words and blah, blah, blah. And we'll pay you $75 for each of these. And I write back, that's adorable. That's the whole reply. That's adorable. Because their business model is, wait, you're a public company. I think about.com. Were they bought by the Times or somebody? $75 an hour. Let's assume you're doing a half-decent job and it takes you 2 hours to write that. Thanks, but no thanks. And if I'm a kid in college, that's fantastic money. I waited tables. I was a bartender. Right. I was a short order chef. I would do anything that I could pay my way through college and grad school. Work for tips. I, you know, danced at the local Stringfellows. Whatever I could do, I would do. That was legitimate. So I'm not afraid of. Listen, I swung a 12-pound sledgehammer one summer, breaking up pools with a contracting group. If you ever want, you talk about sleep. If you ever want to have a good night's sleep, spend 4 hours with a sledge, tearing up the concrete.
You're getting way off
the pool.
Topic.
But and you will sleep.
Let me reel you back in. And Keith says,
"Got
my kid in the car. Watch the language, Red Hulk."
Oh, sorry, Keith. My bad.
So,
how old is the kid? He's probably heard that word before.
Maybe not. But I love this piece, The Dangle.
Yeah, The Dangle is killer.
14th, 2011.
Yeah, The Dangle was just basically saying,
"Wait, this is your piece or David Carr's piece?"
No, The Dangle was David Carr had stimulated me to express some things I had been thinking about for a long time. By the way, Wall Street is notorious for the dangle. Hey, jump through these hoops, do this, do that, and eventually we'll make you rich. When really, again, we could go off topic. The way Morgan Stanley and Merrill
Lynch.
Well,
hold on. Isn't the toothpaste out of the tube on the dangle as well? I mean,
no, because people have figured out that it's a terrible business model. AOL has already made their dumb purchase. There's no one else left to buy these other companies.
No, but people are continuing to create content for free in all of these sites and all of these industries.
Now, when you create content for free on your own blog, that's a different story. Because you're building a brand, you're building a reputation, you're doing all those things that were promised to you elsewhere, but it's yours. You control it. It's your words, your ownership. And at a certain point, I could give you 100 examples, but I got invited. So I know you charge a boatload of money to speak at corporate functions, as do I. We charge what we could get away with.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a boatload, but I don't do it for free.
Then you need a better speaking agent. Well, but it's a non-insubstantial amount of money. It's
right.
So I get invited to speak at my alma mater, which just Stony Brook. I was originally physics and applied math before waking up and saying, if I switch to poli sci, I don't have to.
And you also were on the equestrian team there.
That's a whole other story, but we'll save that for another time. But I get invited by an economics professor to come lecture his class. They just rolled out an MBA program at Stony Brook. And I'm like, it's a schlep out there. And do I really want to do this? And it's my alma mater. And then I go to his blog. And I'm like, oh, my God, his blog is great.
Right.
Noah's Opinion is the name, N-O-H.
I think I've heard that.
He's great. He's a fat guy. Guy's a terrific guy. Stanford undergraduate physics, gets a PhD at Michigan in economics. So he knows economics is essentially nonsense, not a real science. He knows physics is really the shiznit. I'm watching my language. And so I go out and I speak to his class, and they're great, and it was a great time, and I'm like, dude, anytime you want, I'm in.
Right.
If it wasn't for him and the blog and his reputation and my looking at this guy and saying, this guy's really a serious guy, he's smart, he's interesting, that's what that does for you as a person, you as a professional, you as someone with a brand and a reputation. Now, if I went to his blog and it was crazy Nazi stuff, well, I probably wouldn't have done the vent for free. I probably wouldn't have done the vent at all.
Talking to Barry Ritholtz, and we've covered quite a bit. Let me ask you about this, the housing.
David Carr, I forgot his name. That's terrible.
Yeah, David Carr's great.
He's good. He's really good.
He was in that New York Times documentary. He's featured pretty heavily.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Housing, is it real? Is it recovery? And how I read something, and I think we have a guess on this, that housing is recovering, but construction jobs are not, or something.
There's a couple of different aspects to this. It's a little complicated.
And why is it important that housing is recovering? I know a lot of people
housing is a very big portion of the overall economy. We buy houses, we live in houses, we turn around and do all sorts of stuff in houses. It drives retail sales. It drives things at Home Depot and Lowe's and Sears and Bed Bath and Beyond, and go down the list. So,
you taking a phone call right now?
I can't take a phone call now because we're live on the air. If I took a phone call, it would be rude, but at least the driver knows that I'm on the air and I'll probably see him about 8:30. So I would never take a phone call, but I could certainly
Do you think
that.
He understood that?
Absolutely, 100%.
Really?
So yeah. So Tom Keene once looked at me. Look, I've been doing media long enough that I took a phone call. Hey, 30 seconds, I took a phone call. Hey, I'm in the courtyard at 7:15. And he's like, I can't believe you did. I go, Tom, not only did I take the call, I was off the call 4 full seconds before we went live on the air.
Housing.
So housing is kind of complex. Let me give you a long story relatively short. Okay, first, because this was a credit bubble that led to the financial crisis, because the pendulum had swung so far to one extreme, fog and mirror, here's a mortgage. We had a massive overbuild and overbuying in housing and a subsequent collapse. Housing levels are still below where they were at the bottom of prior recessions. So we're still really, really in the crapper on housing. However, you have these two conflicting things driving home prices and driving home sales.
Interest rates?
Interest rates, historical lows, even though they just popped up. You could have gotten a mortgage 3.5% if you, we talked about this. Now we're up to 4.1.
I already refinanced.
That's great. What'd you refinance at?
3.7? I think it's 5-something.
Oh, no, 4.441 right now. Be fantastic. That's number one. Number two, and that's depending on the size of your mortgage, that'll save you $500-$600 a month. So,
but I already did it once. Can I do it again?
You could do a CEMA loan, which is a, you're in New Jersey or New York? You're
New York.
A CEMA loan allows you to do a not a distressed modification, but just allows your
bank. Will you take a look at my thing?
It allows your bank to lower your interest rate, and you don't have to pay the mortgage.
But I already did it once.
Yeah, but you can. That was more than 12 months ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're 5 and change. Probably did it 2 years ago. Take it down to 4%.
Again, so, pay all the closing fees again, too.
No, no, that's what I'm telling you. A CEMA, C-E-M-A, is a mortgage modification that allows the existing mortgage holder to lower your interest rate. You don't have to pay the recording tax, which is almost 1%, but you do have to pay the appraisal fee. It pays for itself in 3 months. So I'm just, that's the you don't go out shopping. You say to your bank, I want to do a CEMA loan mortgage mod. I want to bring my rate down to 4%. If it's more than 0.75%, it's worth doing. And you're over 5, you can bring it down to 4. Hold that aside. So rates are really low, but they've ticked up a little bit. That's what's been a big driver of the interest. So there's 3 factors. Really low rates is our background thing. Second, starting about 1.5 years ago, a whole bunch of private equity companies started raising funds to invest in the equivalent of what we call REITs, R-E-I-T, real estate investment trusts. They're publicly traded generally. What they normally own are things like shopping malls and apartment buildings and office complexes, and they throw off a certain amount of yield. It's tax advantage. It's all passed through to the shareholders. This is all standard stuff. But what these private equity companies set up is rent, buy to rent. They're buying up tens of thousands of private homes and then putting them on the rental market. And what they're doing is selecting the cream of the crop. There's somewhere between $20 and $30 billion in private equity money driving a lot of this. That will eventually run out, right? And what we know about private equity money is the first guy in does really well. The second guy in, not as much, and all the copycats, they all end up losing money. But the third and most important aspect of housing is this. And my friend Jonathan Miller, who I introduced to the show some time ago, describes it thusly. There are about 2 out of 3 homes are owned with a mortgage. 1/3, 30% have no unencumbered, no mortgage. And hopefully they don't get foreclosed on, but we, as we know, that has happened in the past. But of the 2/3 of homes that have mortgages, meaning there's a debt and an encumbrance and the value of the house matters relative to its how much money you borrowed in order to buy it, there's 40% or so, 43% of those people either have low equity, no equity, or negative equity, meaning that they owe $400,000 on a house that's worth $375,000.
Right.
Now, if you owe more than the house is worth, or let's say you owe $400,000, the house is worth $400,000. If that's the case, how are you going to roll into your next house? If you sell this house, at best, you pay off the bank. There are closing costs, there are this, there are that. So maybe you don't even able to make a full payment. Where are you going to go? You don't have a down payment. What happens in a healthy market, you buy the house at $200,000. 10 years later, it's worth $250,000 or $300,000. You sell it, you've already paid off some of the mortgage.
Right.
with the buck that's left over, that becomes a down payment. You buy a house on a 400. Hey, that everybody's happy. Everybody trades up. Isn't life great? And that describes 1946 to 2000, essentially.
And I bought my house after that.
Right. So if you bought your house after that, listen, you still have to live somewhere. If you're renting, you can paint the walls what you want. Home ownership tends to put you in a more desirable school district for your children. Yeah. There are still lots and lots. You get the mortgage deduction. There are plenty of advantages to owning a home, assuming you don't wildly overpay for it. Look, we sold one home at the peak of the market and bought another home at the peak of the market. So I traded up. I got a little more space. I'm right near the water. It's a bigger yard. I like the house. But and then I had to put a couple hundred thousand into the house over the past 5 years as it was falling apart and all original. So if I can I sell the house and get what I paid for it? Yeah. Am I going to get all the improvements, the new kitchen, the new bathrooms, new roof, new furnace, new plumbing, blah, blah, blah? No, that money is gone forever, and I get to live in a house where the toilet doesn't overflow. So
that's kind of me, too.
By the way, the alternative is you're living in a rental. You have no control over your neighbors. You're in a crappier school district. You have a landlord who might decide his brother-in-law is moving in. Get out. I'm not renewing your lease. You have control. So back to the no equity, if you want to know one of the reasons why the housing market continues to go up, there's no inventory because half the people who would normally be selling their house and trading up, that inventory, every buyer that's a homeowner currently is also a seller. That inventory isn't on the market. So we went from too much inventory, driving prices down, to not enough inventory. And that's before we talk about the millions of homes on bank balance sheets, which they're waiting for prices to come up in order to put on the market.
All right, let me just switch gears one more time before we let you go. I know you got your car waiting. Can I do it?
Sure.
All right. The, you know, we're hearing a lot about, you know, the scandals from the Benghazi, IRS. Don't say anything yet. Benghazi, IRS, the reporters, the AP, the Fox News reporter, the Department of Justice. Now this NSA thing. Okay. And we can sort out which are legitimate and how legitimate and how important. But the thing that I've been so outraged by is the outrage about these versus
this.
Well, no, it's real outrage. People are really outraged.
No, they're not.
Yes, they are. You can't say that people aren't outraged.
Do you think Benghazi outrage is real, or is this manufactured nonsense?
People, no, listen, Barry, you can't say that someone is or is not sad, or is not happy, or is not outraged.
I just did.
People can be outraged, and you can't. You can say they shouldn't be, and they should.
Whitewater, I am outraged about Whitewater.
I hear you.
I am outraged about Clinton's murdering Vince Foster.
Let me.
That's called manufactured.
No, it's
outrage.
Not because if you believe that he murdered Vince Foster, it is outrageous.
Then you're a high functioning moron.
It doesn't
and
matter.
You get quarantined from my reading list.
If you are outraged by that,
put on your lawyer hat and pretend this person is on the stand and question their motives, their biases, and their integrity and honesty.
Let me
all
finish.
Right? There's lots of things to be outraged
about. The difference, right. And there's a thing that you wrote an entire book to be outraged by. And that's what I've been saying. I've been saying, if you're outraged by Benghazi or the IRS or any of these things,
you're not paying attention.
You're not paying attention, of course. But, and it's a great bumper sticker, but how come you're not outraged? How come you weren't outraged by the financial industries?
Right.
You know.
The whole Rick Santelli rant about these moochers in the houses. Wait, you're okay with $1 trillion going to the banks who stole money, blew themselves up, acted recklessly, and sailed off to the sunset with zero prosecutions.
Right.
But some poor bastard whose house is in foreclosure and he doesn't even have a mortgage, those guys you're okay with.
That's what I'm talking
That's
about.
That's manufactured outrage.
But
it's full.
The difference, however, is when the private sector, Keith just tweeted a picture of his daughter, by the way.
Oh.
He says she repeats everything. She's 3 and a half.
Really?
But the
tell daddy you want a Camaro.
What about the outrage? What about the outrage with when the government does it with our taxpayer money versus when the private sector does it?
It's manufactured outrage.
Why?
Why? Because so we have gone from a nation. Now, this is a longer answer. I'll give you what I think is my best abbreviated version. We have gone from a nation where there was a sense that the bigger obligation was to society, to the country, to the nation, that it didn't matter if you were Democrat or Republican, if you were independent or if you were Wiccan, it didn't matter. You felt a sense of citizenship and an obligation to the nation. And starting with Newt Gingrich, by the way, I'm an ex-Republican. I grew up a Jacob Javits Republican. So I have a special disdain for the people of the party I grew up with who have gone off the rails. And so I you know, a friend says there's nothing worse than a Republican, than a recovering Catholic. I think a recovering Republican is really in a very different sort of place. So Newt Gingrich essentially made it about him, made it about party over country. It's not country first, it's party first. And that sort of philosophy leads to this manufactured outrage, this selective bias, this confirmation, only reading that which agrees with us, selectively focusing on stuff that matters, ignoring the worst of George Bush, freaking out over the worst of Barack Obama. And by the way, the Democrats do it also, but it's not equivalent. The Democrats, after 9/11, said, hey, we have a higher obligation. And if anything, were idiots when it came to Iraq. Switch the roles. Had Gore been in office when 9/11 happens, there would have been immediate impeachment hearings. The Republicans would have lost their mind. As by the way, every time there's any pseudo-scandal, Benghazi, impeachment. IRS, impeachment. They don't respect Obama as a president or a black man. And so you get this insane overreaction. That, by the way, there were people who insanely overreacted to George Bush, but he gave them lots of material to work with. Obama has had a series, and you know I'm furious at Obama. You know I'm Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, disastrous.
Geithner, they're talking about for the Fed.
Never happened.
Who's going to be the new Fed?
I don't know, but I know it'll never happen. I know there are hedge fund managers with high-powered rifles that will shoot him before he becomes Treasury Secretary. Never, ever, ever happen. I can't imagine that happening.
I'm laughing at assassination.
The worst Treasury Secretary in God knows how long. A suck-up to the banks. He was president of the New York Fed while the whole shitstorm hit everything. Right. Here's a guy. Listen, when there's an accident in an operation, when there's a surgical mistake, you send in a different team of surgeries to fix it because they're objective.
So you don't send Summers and Bernanke. I got it. Plenty of reason to hate.
Not hate
Obama's
him. He's
choices.
Just right. Awful. Continued the bailouts. Didn't stand up to the banks.
Right.
So, by the way, I am not one of these bleeding heart liberal guys who thinks Obama could do no wrong. I've been a very, very serious critic of him, and I held George Bush and Bill Clinton about even in responsibility for the crisis. In the book, I made it very clear. Hey, here's what the Democrats did. It's not 50-50, but it ain't 90-10. It's probably 60-40 or somewhere along those ranges. The Democrats have to take a lot of responsibility also. That said, this Republican Party has become a extreme party. This is not the party I grew up with in Nassau County. The Republican machine out there was very different than this group of crazies. There is a purposeful attempt. The reason, now, by the way, they won't say that they're doing it this way. They'll say it's their ideology and we believe government should be small. If you look at the state and federal hiring under George Bush, but in the recession, during the recession, after recession, it's straight up. If you look at what's taken place under Obama, it's straight down. And if Obama had the state and federal hiring that George Bush did, unemployment would be 5.7%.
That's true.
That's insane. That's an insane number. So the infrastructure was sabotaged, was undercut. This is not country first. Every party, when there's a recession, goes out and does a massive deficit spend. Every party that's out of power complains about it. That's how it's been for centuries. This is the first time that the party out of power, partly because the Democrats are ballless weasels. That's a whole nother discussion. But the party out of power has managed to prevent the normal recession, and this is the worst recession since the Great Depression, the normal Keynesian stimulus that every nation in the world does. The nations that haven't done it, we see in Europe, Turkey and Greece and Ireland and Spain, and they're in the crapper. They're in a deep recession, some of whom are in a depression with 20, 25, 30% unemployment. Yep. There's a very clear choice. We could be the United States that came out of the 70s and did really well, or it could be Europe, which is a disaster. The extreme members of the right wing who have captured what used to be a center-right party, the Republican Party, have prevented this from being a more robust recovery, And the only reason it's a half-assed recovery as opposed to slipping into a recession is because what the Federal Reserve has done.
All right. Barry Ritholtz, I'll let him go. Fantastic as always. We appreciate it. Thank you very much for going in. I didn't go to calls, but I will now if you'd like to. The phone number is 866-994-6343. Are these scandals manufactured outrage, as Barry says? And I certainly agree. Is there a false equivalency? Give us a call right now. Which one of those is real? Benghazi, IRS, APDOJ, NSA, or should we be focused still on what we were talking about, what I was talking about, the outrage over the financial industry that people didn't seem to be bothered by as much? Or when Bush did it, it really wasn't that big of a deal. 866-994-6343. Answer that question. We'll be right back. I've got to walk Barry out, or carry him out.